Now, another interesting set of evidence on metaphysical views is their relationship to cognitive biases. And again, I think this is something which I discovered subsequently to, you know, working out the general theory of metaphysics, but then, you know, I then discovered, well, actually, there's all this psychological research which has been done into cognitive biases, which again seems to back up the model that I developed. There's going to be quite a lot about it in my next book, the fourth volume of Middle Way Philosophy, so it's not something I've yet researched in huge detail, but I thought I would pick out a few examples anyway of cognitive biases. And the key thing to make cognitive biases fit in with the model I developed here is to show how they related to metaphysics. So in each case, the cognitive bias itself is entirely, you know, come from empirical psychology, but the link with the metaphysical belief is the interpretation I've put on it. Cognitive biases generally are, they stop us, they interfere with our judgments, so they're identifiable tendencies that human beings often have to poor judgment in one way or another. First example is anchoring. So, I mean, anchoring seems to me to be about we're just being dependent on a particular cognitive model which determines your selection of information. So the more dependent on your anchor you are, or let's say the respects in which you are dependent on your anchor and becomes metaphysical in effect. If you want to look at empirical research which gives you, you know, further information about the limitations that cognitive models put on us, then look up anchoring, you know, because it will then give you more information about it. Again, this is something I need to research more myself before I can say a lot about it.
I've got kind of reservations about. I can understand how these cognitive biases. I mean, we work a lot with these in CBT.
Right.
So I can understand how metaphysical positions necessarily introduce cognitive bias, but I'm not so sure about the other way around, in the sense that if you could eradicate all metaphysical beliefs, my guess would be that we'd still be left with quite heavy cognitive biases.
Okay, that seems to be quite a big issue, so could we come back to it the end? That's well worth going into. This is just a selection of a few cognitive biases. Yeah. So, attributes such as substitution, where you substitute an easy problem for a difficult one, so the problem that you're faced with in experience is a difficult and complex problem, but to make the problem resolvable, you substitute an easy one for it. And very often, the substitution of an easy problem would be a metaphysical way of explaining the problem.
Just an example.
Yeah. So, a simple example would be something like rather than overcoming a complex practical problem, you appeal to God to solve the problem for you, or you pray to God to overcome that complexity for you, rather than engaging with it. An example is a clustering illusion. So, where there's what appears to be a random pattern, or where, you know, there's no particular reason for us to think that a pattern has particular significance, whether you're finding that pattern in, say, a a visual field, or perhaps in a piece of literature or music or something like this. But you take it to be significant, perhaps in a way which conveys metaphysical truths of such kind. So numerology is a classic example of that, where people get revelatory truths out of the Bible just from the way the numbers of verses, for example, are organised in the Bible.
Is astrology a similar example of that?
It's related, yes. I think astrology is... No, it's another type of cognitive bias, which okay. I haven't got on the list, but yes, there's certainly a relationship there. Confirmation bias is perhaps the most well-known and common one. So just the fact that we seek out information which will support the position we already hold. So on the whole, I mean, I work with quite a few theologians, you know, I've studied theology myself. And it's not true that they only read theology, but, well, I mean, of course, they tend to read theology. So they're much, you know, if you're a theistic theologian, you're not very likely to read atheistic books which assemble evidence or make you aware of models which look the other way. So you're not likely to... most of us don't make enough effort to disconfirm our hypotheses.
Or vice versa. If you are a big Hitchens fan, you're not going to be reading lots of books.
Oh, yeah.
Theism.
Exactly, yeah. Hyperbolic discounting is another one. That's the way in which we assume that things that are nearer in time are more valuable. So, I mean, the way people like Daniel Kahneman put this is that $10 today is worth more to us than $10 in a month's time. You can see that in a more complex way in things like thinking about global warming or how to deal with nuclear waste or something like this, that it's more important to us perhaps to have the pleasures available to us or avoid the pains that might impact on us today than in 50 years or in case of global warming or we're more concerned with getting energy from nuclear fuel today than we are with dealing with nuclear waste in a century. So this is actually part of utilitarianism, and this is part of what makes at least some versions of utilitarianism quite metaphysical. And the calculation involves this assumption that we should give more weight to what is closer in time, certainly that we shouldn't give equal weight even to things which are quite relatively easily predictable, so something like nuclear waste, when you've got a pretty good idea of its half-life and therefore how long it will continue to produce radioactivity. But it's still less important to us what will happen in the far further future. And I think that fits in closely with the self view, and so the tenets of the ego ought to identify with me now and what I am to identify with now, as opposed to leaving in 2 minutes time, let alone further future.
I'm struggling to make the link between metaphysical belief and problems with hyperbolic discounting, for example. So why does that necessarily imply a metaphysical?
Because the belief here is that it's a belief about value and effect, so that the value of things today, or value of things now to us, sort of pleasures now, or limitations of pain now, has a value which is, it's not judged in proportion to its value in the future.
So I can see how that's a kind of slightly irrational assumption to make, or maybe that the way that we are evaluating things is kind of not as helpful as it might be. But again, I'm trying to work out why that's necessarily metaphysical. Because, for example, I could, you could argue quite cogently for a eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die kind of approach to life without holding any metaphysical belief necessarily.
Well, I think that would be based on a metaphysical belief.
Right, in terms of there's no life after death, or
no, after that, but even, you know, that tomorrow doesn't matter. You know, so it's a comparison of the value of today with the value of tomorrow. And say you're giving an absolute value to today which is not applied to tomorrow.
Right.
Which isn't based on experience.
Is it absolute or is it incremental? I mean, it's like you might value today more than you value tomorrow, but to say that you don't care about tomorrow at all. But maybe I'm just thinking about the way that we tend to, we tend to in practice think about, you know, taking care of tomorrow. Yeah, we tend to underestimate the consequences of our actions today on the future, but we rarely discount them altogether. It's not an either or absolute kind of.
Yes, I agree, but I think well what would be justified there is if we did that on the basis of the limitations of evidence. Obviously it's difficult to predict the future.
Yeah.
So if we said, well, we shouldn't give that quite so much weight because we're not so sure about it, that would be incremental. But if we've got just as much evidence for now as we have for the future, or the relatively near future, that we still think today is more important, I think that's just, it's an egoistic projection. Yeah, it's just, we think that our egoistic projection is that, well, actually, today's important to me because I identify with today, and I don't happen to identify with tomorrow, so therefore tomorrow doesn't matter. Yeah. And that's not to do with the evidence about tomorrow, particularly.
So it's like, today's more important than tomorrow because today's more important than tomorrow.
Yes, exactly. but yes, there are issues with interpretation there, and perhaps I could make that a bit clearer. As I say, this is still a bit sketchy because I've got to work this out more fully for volume four. And then the illusion of control is another example. So the... this, I think, is based on, particularly on the free will view. So, the idea that we're, the belief that we're completely responsible for our actions. One example of that is lottery numbers. So the belief that people have that when they choose a lottery number, therefore, this makes it more likely that they'll win, which is used by Camelot to great effect to sell lottery tickets. Or the belief in drivers that when they're in control, there's less likely to be an accident because they're in control. Whereas if someone else is driving, then there might be an accident. So you got and obviously this is also related to our views of self and other ones on, but the way in which we're likely to judge our own case in ways that are different from the other person's.
It's interesting that people who don't know how to drive are often much more relaxed passengers. They find that ability to detect, well, as soon as they have a sense that they could kind of take control of the car, they find it a lot more.
Okay, and then the introspection illusion, which fits in with what Barry mentioned about Descartes. So the idea that if you have a clear or a strong experience of some kind internally, then that must be true, or that, you know, that's the basis of some sort of absolute belief.
Surely the experience itself must be true. It's just how we interpret it that's...
That's a bit clumsily phrased. Yes. It's the claim that we make on the basis of it that must be true. Yeah, you're right. you know, Descartes claimed that in terms of, you know, he must exist because he was having a clear experience, a clear and distinct experience. So therefore there must be an experiencer, he says.
And then he extrapolated that out and said, because I have a clear experience of God, then God must exist.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, that though that was also dependent on the ontological argument, but another version of this, I think, is the revelatory type of belief that because you have an overwhelming religious belief, for example, therefore it must be God communicating to you. An overwhelming religious experience, for it must be God.
What was the circular thing with Descartes again? So because he has a clear and stronger experience of God, therefore God must exist.
Yeah, and God effectively guarantees his experiences that he's not wrong in his interpretation of his experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, and then there's the just world hypothesis. I found this very interesting actually. When I was researching for my thesis, I did quite a lot of work on cosmic justice and sort of beliefs in cosmic justice. So that would include things like the belief that history is laid out in a certain way so that it will all come right in the end. Maybe there'll be a communist society or a new Jerusalem at the end of history where everything will, that the just will be rewarded and the unjust will be punished, that sort of thing. But also cosmic justice includes the theory of karma in Buddhism and rebirth, and you know, the idea that you'll get your just deserts. So the idea really that the whole of the universe is a justice system, you know, and that which ensures that things will eventually turn out right. So the just world hypothesis, I was very interested to then find that, in fact, psychologists had identified the just world hypothesis as a cognitive bias and as problematic psychologically. So it wasn't just a philosophical argument. I think this is one of the first things that set me on the trail of some sort of link with cognitive biases.
George Lakoff talks about that we have these metaphors set up as a moral accounting. Maybe that, again, is an extrapolation of that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's a metaphor taken too literally, as it were, and given an absolute status. So the way it seems to work psychologically is in some way providing us with a sense of security that we will get our just deserts in the end. I've been struggled with this one bit, thinking that sort of the idea that if I've got a good book, then it ought to be published, for example, and you know, I should be rewarded for my efforts, and you know, something's wrong if they're not publishing off. Okay, and then
just first, I'm just interested because I've not come across in sort of CBT, I've not come across the just world hypothesis being flagged up as something possibly worth exploring with clients.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you remember where you got that from, the psychological literature in terms of.
I can give you a reference. There's a book about it by Melvin somebody. I can get you full details.
Sounds really interesting.
Yeah. And then the final one here is stereotyping, which is, you know, widely known about, but where we have a particular belief about a group, which we apply absolutely to the people in that group. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they must all be like that. Rather than accepting the variations within our experience, yeah, that different Jehovah's Witnesses may be different from each other. Okay, so I'll leave it there. Could we come back to Julian's point, which we discussed a bit in the break anyway? Could you just go over the main issue there, Julian? About cognitive biases.
Yeah. So I understand that you probably need some form of cognitive bias in order to maintain a metaphysical belief. But I'm not sure that the reverse argument holds, in the sense that if you were to eliminate metaphysical beliefs, would you eliminate cognitive biases? And I don't I'm not sure that you would. And the reason that I think you probably wouldn't is that these biases are potentially quite built into the way that we construct meaning and belief in the first place. Mm. Almost that actually some degree of cognitive bias is probably inevitable because of the way that we actually form meaning and belief. Mm. So meanings, for something like we were saying yesterday, for something to be meaningful, we have to kind of notice it in the first place. And so our perceptual apparatus is constructed in such a way that it will notice some things and not others. Mm. And we're kind of just bound by that. In order to make a meaningful world, we have to distinguish between one thing and another. We have to therefore prefer one thing rather than another. And therefore, something like the anchoring bias, for example, is always going to be with us to some extent.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I agree with that, you know, that we're never going to completely get rid of cognitive biases, just as we're not going to ever manage to operate without cognitive models, and we're always going to have egos. So it all, you know, for the same reasons that you know, we don't, for cognitive biases to be dependent on metaphysical beliefs doesn't require it to be possible to completely overcome cognitive biases. It's just that it's going to be possible to make progress with them by integrating our beliefs.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting on this as well, the Daniel Kahneman book, Thinking Fast and Slow, it's just so rich. And then he poses himself the question, what can you do about it? And he said, well, very little. And which was a shame. And it was very surprising as well that he didn't seem to acknowledge awareness cultivating practices such as meditation and things like this. And
or which, even CBT. I mean, CBT is founded on the assumption that you can do something about it.
Yeah. We've seen a massive flaw in all this evidence. The guy's won the Nobel Prize for it, basically. I don't know.
I mean, what you're saying about awareness of cognitive biases as well. I mean, it's like, I think a lot of the time, you know, your vegetable biryani or whatever, I mean, if it's not causing a problem, then you're wrong with it.
But I have, just again, knowing that, being aware of that cognitive bias, I think, which I only came across a few months ago, when I go out, I'm aware of that now, so I'm a bit more, incrementally more adventurous in what I eat.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
I think it's helpful to remember where we think these cognitive biases come from in terms of evolutionarily speaking. It's much better to be safe than sorry, and it causes all types of problems for us in other situations. But this notion that when it comes to threat evaluation, a false positive is far less costly than a false negative. So, you know, lion in the bushes kind of thing. If you mistake the presence of the lion when he's not there, it's not anywhere near as, you know, drastic as thinking he's not when he is. So, no.
Yes, I experienced that actually walking through Lapland a few years ago, where, you know, there are bears around, and there was one occasion where I walked into a clearing where I was suddenly electrified. There's definitely a bear over there. And I moved very gingerly. And then I think the light changed or something. Maybe the wind stirred a branch or something and the sun came down so I could see a bit more clearly. And it was a branch covered in moss in exactly almost the right proportions.
Do you also notice that, you know, when you're walking at dusk, especially when you're walking through trees or that you can start imagining stuff and really start seeing things that the tricks that your mind plays on you. Mm-hmm. But it's all there for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Not saying that in a teleological sense.
The thing about today and tomorrow and like planning for the future and that kind of thing, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but because obviously I think it's a good idea to plan for the future, but that could argue that that's a metaphysical claim itself, because you're assuming some continuity of the self.
Well, not if you take into account the ways in which the self may change, which is obviously an incremental, uncertain matter. Yeah, one could plan for the future with more or less understanding of conditions, and one's recognition of conditions needs to recognise as far as possible that one's needs and perspectives in the future may be different from the current ones.
So I guess what we seem to be coming back to is that planning for the future doesn't necessarily entail a metaphysical physical belief, and equally you could say that not planning for the future doesn't necessarily entail a metaphysical belief either. It's like...
Not necessarily. As I say, my hunch here is that it's just to do with uncertainty. If we're taking into account uncertainty, then fine.
Yeah.
But if it's just a question of treating the future different just because it's the future...
Right, yeah. That's the rationale.
That doesn't seem to me justified. Yeah. And obviously the further you go into the future, the more uncertain it becomes. You know.
Yeah.
Making detailed plans for what we are going to do in 3000 CE is a bit stupid.
I guess one of the reasons that we tend to discount the future is partly because the level of uncertainty increases with the temporal distance.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes. But where there were pretty well justified things that you can predict, you know, I think Half-Life is quite a good example of that. You know, because we've got pretty consistently operating laws of physics. Okay, they're within certain Compton model, which may be wrong, but as far as we can tell, radioactivity is pretty predictable, of a piece of nuclear waste. So it's then quite a good test of our attitudes, as to how we treat that pretty predictable continuing reactivity.
Mm.